mission. We put the crowd loud. Fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want. We want. We want. We want. We want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today's program, The Forbidden Bookshelf and Banned Books Week. Censorship comes in many guises, and free expression is still under attack in the so-called land of the free. We'll speak with New York University media scholar Mark Crispin Miller about his latest project about disappeared books on controversial topics. It's called The Forbidden Bookshelf. Peter Hart, the communications director for National Coalition Against Censorship, also joins the program. He'll talk about Banned Books Week, which was celebrated recently in the United States. Finally, we'll conclude the program in conversation with Jerry Condon, the National Vice President of Vets for Peace. He'll talk to us about the resurrection of a famous anti-war vessel called the Golden Rule, that'll be meeting with people for Fleet Week in San Francisco. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we look at various issues of censorship, and our first guest is Professor Mark Crispin Miller. He is a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and the author of several books, including Boxed In, The Culture of TV, The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order, and Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. Most recently, Mark Crispin Miller has also been working on a series for Open Road Media called Forbidden Bookshelf. And the introduction to Forbidden Bookshelf at openroadmedia.com explains this project by stating, for more than half a century, America's vast literary culture has been disparately policed and imperceptibly contained by state and corporate entities well-placed and perfectly equipped to wipe out wayward writings. As America does not ban books, other means, less obvious and so less controversial, have been deployed to vaporize them. The purpose of Forbidden Bookshelf is to bring such disappeared books back to life so that readers may finally learn what those in power did not want anyone to know. And joining us is Professor Mark Crispin Miller to give us an update about Forbidden Bookshelf and talk about broadening definitions of censorship. Mark, you join us by phone.
Nice to be with you guys again. The purpose of this series is to revive titles that have been snuffed out far less obviously and therefore far less controversially than those books that are now and then suppressed in various far-flung school districts, you know, municipalities where people get their knickers in a twist over various erotic classics. So we've all heard about these controversial attempts to ban books like Toni Morrison's Beloved or 1984 or Lady Chatterley's Lover, or Heather Has Two Daddies or Two Mommies, books that offend various religious and sometimes patriotic sensibilities. My view is that that kind of sporadic and occasional suppression of really famous titles that are widely available and universally well-known is nowhere near as troubling or dangerous as the successful extinction of a surprisingly large number of books that they're not erotic classics, but they deal with serious abuses of power, high crimes by the government, corporations, books that really are kind of a threat to the status quo, certainly a threat to various really mighty interests, and that therefore have been pretty much extinguished, you know, killed at birth through various inexplicit means. The series includes a lot of those books, as well as some that did make something of a splash when they first came out, but that just slipped out of print very quickly and that people need to know about. So the purpose of this series is to bring them back with new introductions, unfortunately only as ebooks, because the series would otherwise be economically infeasible. But our aim is to publish them again. Sometimes people say, well, you want this book, you can just go on Amazon and find a used copy. Well, first of all, that's not true of all the titles in the series, because some of them are hard to find even that way. But also, if you go looking on Amazon for a particular title, that presupposes your knowing it exists. The fact is that these are books that most people don't know exist. And there's a difference between some used copies being out there for people to buy and books being published. Publishing is the key thing here, because when you publish a book, you make the world aware of it. Or at least you do if you have friends like you guys who will have me on the radio to talk about the series. Yeah. You know, it's still a challenge. I mean, it was a challenge for these books when they first came out to break through the firewall of the corporate press. And it's still a challenge. So I think it's an exciting project and an important one. So we're eager to spread the word about it.
Mark, you use the word extinction, like the hidden history of the Korean War. Okay,
right.
That's a book I.F. Stone been about out there for a while. How does that become extinct, or what do you mean by that, and how deliberate is that?
Well, you know, in the case of that book, for example, as I'm sure you know, Stone had a very difficult time getting it published at all in the United States. I mean, I think the number of publishers who rejected it was maybe as high as 30. It finally came out from Monthly Review Press, you know, this independent Marxist publishing house, and had a kind of underground reputation. Then was, you know, republished years later, still by a small concern. I want to add parenthetically that the publication of that book kind of destroyed Stone's career for a good 20 years. I mean, he was really outcast because he dared to question the official narrative of how the Korean War started, and he did it while the war was still going on. It is a smashing piece of research, a really powerful book, and contains revelations about that war that people to this day don't know. Again, the book does exist out there, people know about it, but most people are unaware that it exists. They're either unaware of it, you know, across the board, they don't know about it at all, or they're unaware that it's available again. So we brought it back with a new introduction by Professor Bruce Cummings of the University of Chicago, a beautiful introduction. So to answer your question, by extinct, I mean in a state where most people don't know it's there. Even many academics are unaware that these books exist. I can attest to that as a professor myself. And the question, how deliberate is it? I have to say, I think in most of these cases, it's quite deliberate. Let me give you a couple of examples. Another of the books we've brought back is DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain by Gerard Colby. This is an absolutely authoritative history of the DuPont family and the DuPont Corporation from the time they got to this country in like 1802 up to the present. And it is not just a story of that extraordinarily powerful dynasty, but also a story of America itself, of industrialization, of the financialization of the economy. Anyone who really wants to know what's been going on in this country has got to read this book. Well, when it came out in 1974, the DuPonts actually colluded with Prentice Hall, the first publisher, to sink the book, which they did by arranging to have too few copies printed up, fewer than were contracted, so few that there was no way for them, for the publisher, to make a profit on it, so they didn't promote it, books were not shipped, and it kind of disappeared, known only to people who follow this kind of scandal. 10 years later, Lyle Stewart, kind of maverick publisher in New York, brought it out again, and a revised and expanded edition. You're going to love this. It had in it 30 pages concerning what had happened to the first edition. Well, somehow, coincidentally and amazingly, one-third of the print run was damaged, and it was damaged specifically in that those 30 pages were missing from the books. So once again, we could say through happenstance, the print run was damaged in a way that made the book a kind of financial non-starter, and it disappeared again. So we brought it back. Books like Douglas Valentine's The Phoenix Program, an essential history of the CIA's most notorious, one of the most notorious covert operations, and an indispensable book about the Vietnam War. This was a covert program of torture, kidnapping, and assassination of civilians in South Vietnam that the CIA ran for some 7 years during that war. The CIA tried to prevent Valentine from finishing the book by interfering with the research. He sued over this. And when it came out, it was done in by a malicious review by CBS newsman Morley Safer in the New York Times Book Review, which basically accused Valentine of sloppy reporting, making things up. And on the strength of that review, the publisher canceled the paperback deal for the book. A similar thing happened with Christopher Simpson's book Blowback, which is the first and still the best book about U.S. recruitment of former fascists and Nazis during the Cold War. This is a book that is not mentioned or listed in the bibliographies of two recent books on the same subject that were published to a lot of enthusiastic reviews that came out within the last year or so. And it's as if Simpson's book never existed, because he goes further than these more recent books and talks about the incalculable damage done to American politics and society by this wholesale recruitment of ultra-rightist fanatics throughout the U.S. government. So the book has been kind of disappeared in that way. He could only get it published by a British publisher, Weidenfeld and Nicholson. It came out in this country, published by that house, and again, it was done in by a malicious review in the New York Times. I'll just add this very quickly, by Sergei Shmaiman, a longtime reporter at the New York Times, whose own father was heavily involved with some of the Eastern European fascist emigres that Simpson's book deals with. Shmaiman's father was actually an avid defender of Valerian Trifa, who was a fascist Romanian cleric. That doesn't come up in the review. There is no mention of the fact that Shmaiman has a conflict of interest. So, you know, you look at enough of these examples of how these books were kind of done in, you would be extremely trusting, and I think a bit naive, to think that this kind of thing was not deliberate, that these books were targeted.
Certainly, Mark Crispin Miller, nefarious, insidious, but censorship nevertheless. You're tuned to Pacifica Radio. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller. Among the many things Mark has done over his illustrious career, the most recent is something called Forbidden Bookshelf, and it is resurrecting these books that somebody or somebodies or certainly some very powerful people and institutions didn't really want you to read or hear about. And we're going through a list of many of them right now. You can learn more at openroadmedia.com. That's where the e-books are all published. These are in e-book form. And Mark Crispin Miller, among the most recent here, we spoke with Peter Dale Scott recently about Dallas 63. That's one of the more recent e-publications from the series, is it not?
Yes, it is. It's part of the latest tranche of titles, and we're delighted that Peter let us do it. And as I think he told you, this version of Dallas 63 is considerably revised and expanded beyond its previous versions. So it's quite exciting, especially since books on subjects like the Kennedy assassination are of particular interest to us in this series. But we've also done a book in the same tranche of titles called Inside Job by Stephen Piso and others, which is about the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. And we have coming out in the next few months The Wages of War by Richard Severo, which is the only history of how the veterans of all of America's wars, from the Revolutionary War up through the Vietnam War, have been, with the exception of World War II, have been monumentally screwed over after those conflicts have ended. This is a really indispensable history of that particular phenomenon, and it's therefore one that people really need to know about, because, you know, the fate of our war's veterans is not improved any since that book came out. There are many others, but let me conclude by saying that we're really intent on bringing these books back, first of all, because they're all excellent books, and their authors, both living and deceased, certainly deserve a second chance. But more importantly, we want to bring these books back because the American people deserve and need to read them. It's because of books like these, not books like Lady Chatterley's Lover and Howl and Beloved, books that I personally love. This is not to disrespect them, but the purpose of the First Amendment was not to protect edgy literary works. I mean, you know, erotic classics is a concept unknown to the likes of John Adams. The purpose of the First Amendment, rather, was to protect the authors and reporters of information that could threaten the power of the government. they wanted to protect the press and expression generally from government interference, from that kind of tyranny. And the books that we're bringing back are precisely the kinds of books that I think the, you know, drafters of the First Amendment would have understood the American people need to read, because if you don't know about this sort of dark side of American history, you're at risk. You know, your rights are at risk. Your freedoms are at risk. Your wealth, your property, your welfare, all these things are at risk. So, you know, we see this project as somehow profoundly patriotic in the best sense. So I'm really grateful you guys have had me on to talk about them.
Mark Crispin Miller, will certainly have you on again to do more uncensoring of our unhistories, right, and going down into memory hole lane here to bring up these very important counter-narratives to what we oft see in U.S. and global history, for that matter. Forbidden Bookshelf is the series, openroadmedia.com. You can learn more. Mark Crispin Miller, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Anytime, guys. Thanks a million.
We've just been speaking with New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller about his series Forbidden Bookshelf. Up next, we'll be joined by National Coalition Against Censorship's communication director, Peter Hart, and we'll be speaking about Banned Books Week. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're continuing our theme of censorship. We've been addressing forbidden bookshelf or historical books that were banned and resurrected. And now we're going to talk about Banned Books Week, which was celebrated recently in the United States. And to do that, we're joined by Peter Hart. Peter Hart is the National Coalition Against Censorship's Communications Director. For 15 years, he worked at the National Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org, where he wrote numerous articles and co-hosted the nationally syndicated radio program Counterspin. Peter Hart joins us today by phone. Peter, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Peter Hart, tell us about your work with National Coalition Against Censorship, of which Project Censored is a proud member. We're proud to belong to NCAC and support all the great work that NCAC does. But tell us more specifically, you finished not long ago this campaign called Banned Books Week that's been going on for decades. Tell us a little bit about what was going on for Banned Books Week and NCAC's role.
I think people are familiar with Banned Books Week if they walk into a public library or to a decent independent bookstore that week. And the idea is to celebrate the freedom to read, to celebrate the victories over government or private suppression of speech, the banning of books from school libraries, from high school or middle school curricula, and so forth. And I think to raise awareness of the fact that these battles continue to go on, whether it is a parent who objects to a world history class that discusses Islam, or a parent who wants LGBT books out of the children's section of the library because they promote perversion. These are still very much live issues, and Banned Books Week tries to, I think, thread that needle to say, we've had a history of censorship, and we've overcome and won many of those battles, but there are still battles that are being fought every single day in schools and in libraries across the country.
We're speaking with Peter Hart from the National Coalition Against Censorship and discussing Banned Books Week that was held recently and celebrated in the United States. To learn more, you can go to bannedbooksweek.org. You can also see NCAC, National Coalition Against Censorship. That's NCAC.org. So, Peter Hart, what do we mean then by celebrating Banned Books Week? Certainly we're not celebrating the banning of books and censorship, but could you sort of frame that for us?
I think the celebration comes from different angles, from the groups like the American Library Association to celebrate the role that librarians have played in protecting users' ability to read what they want, whether they're children or adults. It celebrates booksellers and book publishers who have on many occasions been courageous in their attempts to bring certain books to the marketplace and to make sure that they stay there. So it is this moment where different sectors of these worlds, the free speech organizations, the publishers, all pause to say, you know, there is a history in this country of promoting and defending radical dissident literature, performing arts, music, even in some cases, and it's a chance to recall some of those battles. You know, what we did at NCAC, for example, was just looked at the year that passed, and a school in North Carolina where a parent wants to remove the Kite Runner because she thinks it's inappropriate for the high school students to read there. And what happened? Well, you know, the local donut shop decided they were going to gather as many copies of this book that they could and give them away for free because they thought it was important to send that message that kids should not be prevented from reading something that might enrich their lives and empower them as young adults. A young adult novel in South Carolina is pulled from the curriculum because one parent thinks it's too explicit. Well, a blogger and a librarian work together and say, well, why don't we raise money? As many people who can donate a copy of this book to the library as possible, store them at the library, and give them away for free to any student who shows up. Well, they get hundreds of copies of this novel, Some Girls, and suddenly the young people in Columbia, South Carolina, are not being prevented from reading something, but it's being promoted. So you do have, I think, these important victories, and at the same time, they're not all victories. In Iowa, a school did not want children to read a Sherman Alexie book. His book is usually tops the top five or top ten lists every year, and a parent complained, and what they did, instead of dealing with it in a professional manner, the way they're supposed to, is they said, well, don't write down your complaint. We'll remove it from this middle school curriculum, and nobody will be will understand or know that it happened. Of course, the teachers were furious, the librarians were furious, but they didn't have levers with which to fight back. So you have, I think, a mixed scorecard, and we have to be honest about the fact that citizens have risen up in some of these places and said, no, not here, not to my children, whereas in other places these efforts have been less successful for now. The hope is that in the long run, people begin to understand that children or young adults don't need to be shielded from the realities of life. They need to learn how to grapple with these important questions, whether they be questions in literature or art or world history. They're important lessons that young people can learn from reading material that challenges them, that challenges their parents' way of thinking. I think most of us, and certainly most of the people listening to this radio show, had a moment in their lives where they were exposed to information that contradicted what they had understood about the world up to that point and changed them as human beings. I know it's true for me, and it's true for most of the people I know who got involved in freedom to read or free speech or political organizing. And the idea that young people are prevented from following that path is really ultimately destructive and harmful. So the idea is to promote the idea that young people can have the freedom to inquire and to search and to read as much as they can in order to forge their own path.
Well, Peter, certainly that's a celebration aspect of this week, and certainly celebrating those activists who in many areas across the country are doing those battles with school boards, with people in their own communities where books are being asked to be withdrawn from curriculum or pulled out of the library or an access in some way is limited. However, we read about how Ruth Graham at Slate wrote that there is basically no such thing as banned books and wanted to get your take on that. And it seems that I think it's implied that the government's not banning books overall, but these are incidental happenings. So how did you respond to her?
Yeah, it's a deep question, you know, and it's something I'm sure I don't need to tell anyone around Project Censored that people's ideas of what censorship is and is not can be very complicated and confusing, and they sort of need to be unpacked. Her piece was called, you know, This is the Internet, so we pick subtle headlines. Banned Books Week is a crock. And the argument, let me tell you what she got right, I guess, because it's important to understand this. She was trying to argue that there's a difference between a parent or a community member challenging a book in a curriculum and a book being banned. And that's important. There is a difference between challenging something and a school board or a school district saying this should be removed from the classroom. They're not the same thing at all. And some challenges are good if we can use a value judgment when parents and teachers or anyone else decides they want to question what's being taught in school. That often can be a very beneficial process. You know, this week we saw a student who noticed that his world history textbook in high school referred to slaves as workers in a picture caption. So he took a photograph of it, sent it to his mother. His mother recorded a Facebook video. It's been viewed 2 million times. And the publishing giant that is responsible for this book is rewriting it. They're going to send out stickers to cover this up. And it fueled this whole discussion about how do we teach children about slavery? How do we teach U.S. history? How do we teach world history? That's important, and it's a good thing for anyone to speak up against powerful institutions, and these challenges happen. I guess the distinction to be made is what kinds of challenges and on what grounds, and we're talking about the numbers that are compiled by the ALA, and they say we're aware of about 300 such challenges a year, usually about inappropriate content in books at the middle school and high school level, language, sexual content, that sort of thing. And we have to understand that's the 300 that we know about that are reported publicly or reported directly to the ALA. It's a vast undercount of the whole problem. So we know that number just gives us a slice of what's going on. We know that schools and librarians are fearful about speaking up about this. We know that these kinds of challenges can lead to what we like to refer to as a chilling effect. If a librarian goes through a problem where, you know, 10 very noisy parents want this gay and lesbian book taken out of the library, how does that affect the librarian's choice of books going forward? Has this person learned a particular lesson? Very difficult to get at that kind of stuff, and that's where the effects of censorship can be hard to track and hard to parse. You know, the School Library Journal tried to do a study of this a couple of years ago, surveying librarians, and they did find, you know, I think something like 70% of librarians said that a challenge affected their future book buying. That suggests that the process can be very stressful, that librarians might be worried about their jobs, and they learn lessons to avoid certain kinds of content. You know, when we talk about this in the realm of journalism, for example, we say journalists learn the rules of the road if they're working in sort of high-profile corporate media, that there are risks to offending certain sponsors or to your owners and so forth. This isn't written down somewhere. Journalists don't like to talk about it, and the same is true, I think, for educators and librarians. It's a dirty little secret, as the School Library Journal put it. So we have, I think, real serious evidence that there is a chilling effect, that it affects how librarians or administrators or English teachers go forward. I mean, imagine you're teaching 11th grade AP English and you start receiving complaints that what you're teaching in your class is inappropriate. Now, let's hope that you have the job security and the strength to say, no, here's why we teach that and here's why it's important. But many teachers might feel otherwise. And other teachers might observe the lesson of your, you know, of the of what you go through and say, you know what, I'm going to avoid that. The other problem, and this comes up a lot in her piece and elsewhere, is that, well, if a book is removed, it's removed because parents wanted to have a say in their child's education, and it's silly to say that that should be forbidden or something. And that's a straw man. You know, no one is saying that parents shouldn't be involved in their kids' schools or their kids' education. The distinction is, should one parent be able to control the curriculum for an entire classroom or an entire grade level because he or she has religious views or moral views that they find are undermined by what is taught in the classroom? That's the distinction. And when you allow one person's complaint to drive curricular choices, you're no longer putting teachers and educators and administrators in control of that. You're trying to appease a small group of individuals who have a problem with this or that. That is the kind of situation that we have to avoid if we're to have strong and independent public schools. The other argument that is made in her piece and is made elsewhere that, well, you know, we have Amazon, we have public libraries. A book is no longer banned. You just have to go buy it somewhere else or check it out of the library. Stop with all the fear-mongering and the nonsense. And the appropriate reaction to that, I think, is that, A, those avenues aren't available for all students, and, B, there is an important aspect of teaching students about a given work, to having classroom discussions, to exploring this with a professional educator who's thought about how to teach difficult subjects. The difference between reading a people's history on your own and reading it in class with your classmates, the latter is, I think, a far more enriching and nourishing experience, and one that I would wish on any high school student in the country. So to say, well, because some parents don't like that book, you can read it on your own, yeah, that's great, I understand that. But a more powerful and, I think, a more transformative experience is when students who aren't seeking out that kind of information are forced to grapple with it and to understand and to, I think, expand their minds. That's what school is for, and that, I think, is the kind of the missing piece in these arguments about whether books are really, quote-unquote, banned. In the end, we want schools to expose students to a wide variety of topics and a wide variety of issues, and the way to do that is in the classroom.
And Peter Hart, what we're talking about here, all of these issues, from self-censorship, a chilling effect, sort of rippling from the challenges, not outright bans, and ultimately you're referring to a winnowing of, you know, what's considered legitimate dialogue or discourse, or what are the appropriate topics that can be discussed here. And I mean, and that does amount to an issue of censorship. And it also paves the way to create, again, an appearance, particularly in educational institutions, that there's a legitimation. It's a propaganda of sorts, of a legitimation that these are the texts and the things that are discussed and these ones aren't. And while they're technically not banned, we're also subtly or not so subtly suggesting that maybe these ideas aren't worth considering. And that's definitely a problem, and certainly at Project Censored, we think that's a huge problem. I'm speaking with Peter Hart, Peter Phillips, my co-host. We're talking about Censorship and Banned Books Week. Peter Hart is the communications director at National Coalition Against Censorship. Of course, they're one of the many sponsors and supporters of Banned Books Week. And Peter Hart, you mentioned a couple of studies here. You pointed out the fact of American Library Association saying that 80% of challenges go unreported. You also said a school library journal study from 6 years ago, they surveyed 600 librarians and revealed 70% claimed that the reaction from parents or what have you created sort of this possible chilling effect. And it gives people pause, right? So we're talking about expanded definitions of censorship here, not just banning. And I think your rebuttal, by the way, listeners can check out Peter Hart's rebuttal. It's Long Lived Banned Books Week. It's on the National Coalition Against Censorship site, NCAC.org. That's a reaction to Ruth Graham's article, provocatively titled Banned Books Week is a Crock. And I think listeners would be very interested to go and read the back and forth there and get a little more depth about what we're discussing here. Remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about Censorship and Banned Books Week. Peter Hart, let's take a slightly different direction, certainly related to this subject and this discussion. And I know NCAC has dealt with this issue, and it's something that's also part of Banned Books Week. Recently, both for Constitution Open Day and Banned Books Week, I held a panel on my campus at Diablo Valley College about trigger warnings in the First Amendment. And I was curious to get your take on what role trigger warnings play and what some of your views might be about the issues of trigger warnings and potential speech codes on campus, and then the overlap with that's another kind of potential banned books issue.
Right. And, you know, this is an incredibly hot issue in higher education circles and certainly in the popular press. It is generally portrayed as efforts by left-leaning students, politically active students, to avoid or to challenge material, particularly when it comes to material that discusses rape or sexual assault, but that's not exclusively that, to say that professors should warn students ahead of time, that some students could have reactions to reading or discussing or even viewing certain materials. The worry is, of course, that professors, some of whom or many of whom are in a precarious labor situation, might in turn avoid difficult material altogether because they don't want to run the risk of offending a student or making a student uncomfortable or a student leave the room because they can't deal with this or that. It's an issue that's got an enormous amount of attention, even though there are really no formal trigger warning policies in effect at any campuses anywhere. What has been happening, and this is a little bit like the censorship discussion, is that there are kind of informal rules and compromises that are made where professors are altering the way they teach or offering warnings about specific subjects. And there's a couple of reasons why that is troubling. One of the most obvious reasons is that it flags certain types of content as potentially offensive when in reality you don't know what's going to offend someone. So you've sort of prejudged the content for the audience to say, just so that you know, this book, on this day, we're going to read a passage, and it's going to have something in it that's going to make you feel, some of you feel uncomfortable. Well, what if something entirely different makes a student feel uncomfortable? How then do you just issue a blanket warning about all content that you're going to encounter through the semester? It's a fundamentally difficult to unworkable, untenable situation. The other point to this, though, that I think is really interesting and something that has not been explored much at all in the popular press is the fact that the politics of trigger warnings are much more complicated than people make them out to be. You know, we did with a couple of other groups a survey of instructors. How often do you use trigger warnings? What effect do you think they'll have on classroom discussions? And one of the most intriguing findings is that teachers that reported using these kinds of warnings often do it to protect conservative or religious students, students who might have a problem with nudity or homosexuality, Muslim students who might have certain moral identities that they don't want compromised or questioned. So the discussion we're having about trigger warnings, I think, generically suggests that it's feminists and student activists from the left who are demanding people avoid content that's going to make them feel bad. In reality, it is often students from the other political direction who are being either sought out to sort of grant trigger warnings to or demanding them in class. So it's a very complex political situation and one that I think requires more complexity in its discussion than what we're seeing in the popular press, which I think is mostly along the lines of college students are crybabies and they all want to be coddled and, you know, we need to tell them all to toughen up and have thicker skin. Well, that's true enough. I think it suggests that this survey at least suggests that what's going on is much more interesting and I think difficult to wrap your head or get your hands around, but nonetheless something that we're going to be debating. And if we're going to be debating it, we should have a really good understanding of what it is. And I feel like that's so far something that we're failing to do.
Peter Hart, certainly Project Censored's been addressing these issues now 39 years. And the idea of censorship, just like the Banned Book Week, no banned books in the country, the idea that you get people saying, well, there is no censorship, you know, not overtly, but it is subtle. There is trigger warnings, which implies a sort of self-censorship within the classroom, within the libraries, certainly within the newsroom that's ongoing. Adam Horowitz has a piece in the Censored 2016 book about the movie Nuclear Savage, which was scheduled to be aired on PBS nationally a couple years ago and then was completely dropped. And this, of course, is the atom bomb tests, hydrogen bomb tests in the Marshall Islands back in the 50s that contaminated large numbers of people. And then they were studied experimentally in terms of the radiation impacts, and this film quite exposes that. But it's been completely banned. So clearly a film can get made, but if it's not shown and no one can see it, it's an amazing film. I showed it in my class, and the students are like, oh, my God, that we're doing this. So there's topics, I think, that can't be covered as well in terms of censorship. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, you know, and I think to go back to that Slate piece, the author would presumably tell you, well, the filmmakers could just put it on YouTube somewhere and it would be available if somebody knew how to find it, and there you go. And, you know, obviously those of us who take a more nuanced view of the world would say it's quite a different thing to be on national public television and to expose audiences who weren't searching out that content to it. So I think the conversations have to be a lot more nuanced and I think a lot broader. The Palestine Legal Center has this new report that they did with the Center for Constitutional Rights about the Palestine exception to free speech, and it's about attacks on pro-Palestinian advocacy, often on college campuses, that take the form of outright censorship, intimidation, harassment, bureaucratic loopholes. And it's a fascinating report because, you know, many of these things fall under a gray area when we take a very strict definition of censorship. Has the government prevented someone from saying X, Y, or Z? Well, you know, most examples are not that clear. But when an administration pressures a student group to add additional speakers to an event so it's more quote-unquote balanced, or moves the location, or says we can't have this because there are safety concerns, that is certainly a chill on free expression. That is certainly a form of censorship, and it's something that has to be called out. Now, it's not always going to be as simple as a local school board or a university dictating a formal policy. There are unwritten rules and, I think, informal policies. Public broadcasting is a great example, as you brought up, that we have 20, 30 years of this, where documentaries that are, I think, especially critical or touch on issues that might offend donors or benefactors or politicians, those films have to cross a much higher threshold if they're to be seen at all. Now, would you call that formal government censorship? Perhaps you would, perhaps you wouldn't. The end result is the same. We're choking the flow of information because we don't like the ideas contained in this film or this book, and that should be of equal concern to anyone who cares about this stuff.
Peter Hart, National Coalition Against Censorship. You know, at Project Censored, you know, our definition of censorship since 1976 has really not changed, and it is something where there's been criticism, but we strongly believe, and we think that we have 39 years of evidence to suggest, and certainly the work of FAIR and everything going on at NCAC, Banned Books Week, it really supports the notion that censorship is anything that interferes with the free flow of information in a society that purports to have free expression, free speech, free press principles. And it's not simply the notion of the government stopping it. But we have 90% of the media in the United States controlled by six private for-profit corporations. That means publishing houses, airwaves, etc. I mean, so censorship is, again, far more insidious of a thing, and it's more by degree, and it involves things like framing or sliding of content, right? I mean, so it isn't just the blacking out. By the way, not that we don't still have government blacking out of stories, right, vis-a-vis WikiLeaks, right? We certainly see that that is still going on. But on a broader level and a more regular basis, censorship has, again, these varying degrees up to and including self-censorship. We just mentioned a little about trigger warnings. And I think it's fascinating that not only have we seen reaction to this, Greg Lukianoff at the Foundation of Individual Rights and Education, The Fire, had a great piece in The Atlantic a month or so ago about trigger warnings and academic freedom. And so too, even President Barack Obama made remarks about supporting academic freedom, which, again, I was somewhat surprised by and can't say I agree with Obama on so many things. But I think that was at least heartening that the level of discussion about this is kind of leaning on the side, at least rhetorically, on free expression. But then again, you brought up the Palestinian question. We know Professor Stephen Salaita fired from a tenured track job before he even got to start teaching because of remarks he made about Palestine. So riffing on what Peter Phillips said, there are these topics that seem to be verboten. And Banned Books Week every year really kind of hits on these topics. Certainly we hit on these topics at Project Censored. What else is National Coalition Against Censorship working on right now? What are some of the other frontline battles and other ways you're promoting education about censorship at National Coalition Against Censorship? Peter Hart?
Well, we're working on this report about a survey of professors regarding trigger warnings, and our hope is that it's going to expand the discussion of this topic so that people begin to understand that in the real world where professors are teaching and questioning these ideas and dealing with students' concerns, the requests to avoid certain content or to be warned of certain content is a lot broader than we think. I think it has more profound academic freedom implications than we think. So the hope is that it kind of enlarges that conversation so that people begin to understand that it's not just about feminist students who don't want to read this or that. And if we can do that, that would be, I think, of enormous benefit to anyone who cares about free speech and free expression. We're working on a project about student free expressions, particularly on social media, the private companies that monitor Twitter and Facebook feeds on behalf of schools and school districts to flag quote-unquote inappropriate content. This is, I think, an issue that flies under the radar because students often who are sanctioned or who are punished do not want to speak out for fear of doing further damage to their academic futures or to their job prospects. But there are real concerns about surveillance and about the ability of students to speak to one another in this relatively unmoderated space, that is Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the like. So I think there are these new avenues where the free speech battles are being fought. And they're often outside of government control. They're private companies that have their own rules of the road. So we have to start asking kind of big picture questions about what is the responsibility of a private company like Twitter or Facebook to core free speech principles? As private corporations, they really don't have any. They make appeals and, you know, they can generate rhetoric in this regard. But what are their rules and what are the limits and how can we push them to change the practices that are in place to encourage a more robust national conversation about issues that people want to keep under wraps? Those are the big questions, and those are the things I think we're trying to tackle in addition to the challenges to books in libraries and schools, which I think are the kind of bread and butter free speech issues we've been working on for going on over four decades now.
Peter Hart, you're the communications director of National Coalition Against Censorship. We'd like to thank you for all the work you're doing at NCAC, certainly the work you've done for fairness and accuracy in reporting over the years. I think we can kind of, I want to sum up our conversation, or the late, great Eduardo Galeano once wrote, "What is the use of writing if not to defy the blockade which the system places round the dissident message? By writing it is possible to offer, despite persecution and censorship, the testimony of our time and our people for now and for posterity." And I think that's certainly a thematic message that ripples right through Banned Books Week. Certainly all the great work of librarians and others at the American Library Association, ALA.org. So listeners can go to ALA.org, NCAC.org, and BannedBooksWeek.org to learn more about some of the things that we've been discussing today. Peter Hart, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Peter Hart from National Coalition Against Censorship. Before that, Mark Crispin Miller about Forbidden Bookshelf. Up next, we speak with Jerry Condon, Vice President of Veterans for Peace. He talks about Fleet Week, which was celebrated recently in the San Francisco Bay by the U.S. Navy. He's aboard the Golden Rule vessel, which is an historic ship that protests the presence of the Navy. Stay with us for that conversation. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and here is my co-host Peter Phillips to introduce our final segment today.
Jerry Condom is the National Vice President for Vets for Peace. He's a Vietnam-era vet and opposed actively the war then and refused to go. And he's part of the Shore Support Group for the Vets for Peace ship called the Golden Rule, which is out among the U.S. Navy ships during Fleet Week here in the San Francisco area. So Jerry, tell us what you're doing.
Well, just really want to thank you first for having me on Project Censored. I'm a big fan. I've been listening to you over the years and really appreciate the work you do. And I'm really excited to be part of this whole Golden Rule effort. The Golden Rule is a national project of Veterans for Peace. It's a very, very special historic boat that actually was found on the bottom of Humboldt Bay 5 years ago and dragged up and was about to be destroyed and burned when people learned of its heritage, its history. It's arguably the world's first peace boat. It was sailed in 1958. It's a 30-foot ketch sailboat, wooden boat. It was sailed in 1958 from Los Angeles to Honolulu and then an attempt to enter the Marshall Islands by four Quaker peace activists who were trying to disrupt U.S. Nuclear atmospheric testing in the Marshall Islands. And they were actually stopped by the Coast Guard in Honolulu. They had broadcast their intentions, and they were arrested and jailed for about 60 days, illegally, as it turned out, and unconstitutionally. But they were kept from going on to the Marshall Islands, but another boat in the harbor at the time, another American family in the Phoenix of Hiroshima, was inspired by their actions and actually continued the mission into the Marshall Islands, and they were arrested once they entered the test zone. Now, this actually brought worldwide attention to atmospheric nuclear testing and helped create quite a movement against it. And actually, just 1 year later, in 1959, President Eisenhower stopped the atmospheric testing, and in 1963, President Kennedy signed an international partial test ban treaty with the UK and the USSR. So this is part of, like, really strong history. And the people who were on this boat went on to be leading activists in the civil rights movement in the South and the peace movement generally. And so there's just an amazing history to this boat, which actually was the boat that inspired Greenpeace to get its first boat. So it's got a rich, rich history. VFP and Quakers and boat people and a lot of other friends have been working hard, mostly volunteer labor, for the last 5 years. And hundreds of people have donated money to get this boat back in the water. And on June 20th, we had a big splashdown party up in Eureka, up on the north coast, attended by, you know, people from Japan and people from all over the country and people who had relationships with these families. And actually one of the original crew members, Orion Sherwood, joined us. And then we made our maiden voyage down to San Diego in time for the San Diego Veterans for Peace Convention in early August and the commemorating the 70th anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki U.S. bomb attack. Nuclear bomb. And now we are actually working our way back up the coast. We've been port hopping for a few weeks, stopping in a lot of different places and having events talking about the continuing threats posed by nuclear weapons and nuclear power and climate change, and had quite a great reception. VFP groups and other groups all along the way doing a great job hosting us and getting publicity for the Golden Rule. And now we're here in the San Francisco Bay. We've actually been here a couple of weeks almost. We were in South Beach Harbor in San Francisco, then over in Berkeley, Marina, and we're here during this week of Fleet Week, which is a big display of militarism, and that happens every year here in the San Francisco waterfront. Our intention is to be very visible with our red sails and a big white peace sign. And
you can't miss you. You know, you got this 30-foot boat and big sails, Vets for Peace, and you're right in the thick of it there. So you've got the U.S. Navy celebrating themselves and militarism and flyovers and big ships and everything, and you're going to be right in the middle of that. Your primary message, what's the objective here?
Well, we're sailing for a nuclear-free world. We want to get rid of nuclear weapons, number one. And it's interesting that the Marshall Islands, where this whole thing started, is now suing all of the nuclear powers, all nine nations that have nuclear weapons there, including the United States, of course, because none of them are living up to their obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to negotiate in good faith to reduce and eventually eliminate all nuclear weapons. And so that's what has to happen. Instead, what's happening in the U.S. is that the government just announced they're planning to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years to develop a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. This is totally unacceptable. And you know, we somehow squeaked by and survived the Cold War without having a nuclear conflagration. But now these weapons are spreading all over the place. We're building new generations of them. And at the same time, as we're playing this brinksmanship policy, threatening Russia, a nuclear power on its own borders and in Syria. So it's a very dangerous situation. Fukushima has shown us that the nuclear power is also a very, very bad idea. And, of course, it's the flip side, the other side of the coin, because you need that nuclear power to produce the plutonium for the nuclear bombs. And so we're opposed to that. We're opposed to the uranium mining and the 10, 15,000 abandoned uranium mines that continue to cause radiation poisoning, particularly on the Native American lands in this country. So the whole nuclear cycle has got to be exposed and eliminated.
Well, Jerry, I'm proud to say that with the local Vets for Peace group in Santa Rosa, I was probably one of the contributors to your boat, and it's so good to see it out there and engaging and so public and so visible during Fleet Week here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that there are veterans that are concerned about war, concerned about nuclear war in particular, and the history of the boat is amazing. So where could people go to get more information online about this?
Well, they can go to VFP, that's for Veterans for Peace, VFPGoldenRuleProject.org. There's a lot of information there. You can also find VFP Golden Rule Project on Facebook. You can find out how to get involved, learn more about the boat. If you wish to make a donation, be a plank owner, that would be wonderful. Also, especially veterans that may be in your audience, we encourage them to check out Veterans for Peace. We'd love to have you join us and reach us at veteransforpeace.org.
Jerry Condon, National Vice President for Veterans for Peace, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored show airs on 25 stations around the United States. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little poison, the weapons manufactured, paid for by attacks upon the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love of the brothers and our sisters.